quarter four of the financial year 2015 and financial and the first quarter of financial year 2016-17. So I think at the back of our mind should be the threat plan and the APT that were presented to us. Since we are also nearing the midterm review, actually we just about to be there. Will be the fourth quarter report will be part of that review and in preparation for our big report R. We need also to remember this is the halfway towards the implementation of full implementation of the NGP, and hence this celebrates the 5 years of NGP, if I'm not mistaken. So this mid-year review will be also very interesting as time goes on to get as to how far have we gone with the NGP. But nevertheless, let me not put you on another issue that is not part of this meeting of today, but rather focus on the day's work. What we'll do, we'll allow the department to, through the mouthpiece of the minister, to give us a fourth quarter report, and just immediately after that, also give us the first quarter report, so that you can be able to engage with it to see how you actually moved from the fourth quarter issues to the first quarter issues. Because I think they are somehow interrelated. I'm told there are two members of the department that joined us today. New people who are meeting with us, they might not be that new in the department, but they are meeting with us at the same time. We want to congratulate them. If I can be reminded of the names, because I don't want to mention wrong names.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you. We have Lawrence Makwana, who is head of our corporate management, and Tukosa, who came from provincial government and joined the OGT's office as parliamentary liaison working in Pretoria. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Atindichi, for that introduction. We just want people to feel, you know, at home and feel the warmth of these members, because we're not here to punish anyone. We're just here to be partners in the self-delivery issue. It's not your issue. It's everybody's issue. We may have a different way or approach of dealing with issues. The fact is we are all serving the same people. So you're mostly welcome to the family economy development, and we hope you'll enjoy your stay with us. May I, without further waste of time, hand over, Mem Rancho, Christian National Data Fest, I'm used to saying this to you. Mem Rancho?
Chairperson, can the House excuse me for 15 minutes? I'll be back.
We were going to come back to the approaches, and I thought you'll come in that. Thanks also for reminding me. Peter Pott?
Chair, I'd like to put it on record that we have not received any apologies for this meeting.
Thank you very much. Yes, Vicky has registered with me that she's going to a short meeting and she'll be joining us later. Bambasa?
Just want to pass my line at once. I will leave at 12:45.
It's okay, even though we don't have reasons, but it's fine. We take it that you're a responsible member. You are going to do a responsible thing. overdue minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to all the members of the committee and the staff of the department and the visitors today. Chairperson, it's been a while since the committee has had an opportunity to reflect on the IPPs, and today we're tabling the quarterly report, the last quarterly report for the old APP and the first quarterly report for the new APP. So it's quite an interesting opportunity to see how we best capture what we're trying to do. I should also indicate that our period covers effectively the first 6 months of this calendar year, because quarter four covers January to March, and then of course quarter one is from April to June. So it's, it covers the period that we have official statistics available for. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. And by way of the reports, what I wanted to do is to highlight, in particularly on quarter four, some of the key areas. We will come back, in a sense, to some of the issues in quarter four, where the annual report of the department that is due fairly shortly, it will take a view of the year as a whole. So I would, with the permission of the committee, spend a little bit more time in quarter one, because that will not be the subject of the annual report. So given that as a background, the report on quarter four covers the activities of the department across the various APIs, and it's set out in the document. So if I highlight them, there's a slide dealing with the context, and I'm going to use the screen just to guide my own contribution. So slide two, I think the members of the committee will be very familiar with. The next slide, slide three, is a snapshot of what happened in the economy, followed by what happened on jobs. And I think, in summary, it was quite a rough quarter for the economy, the period January to March.
I just want to go out for an animation. Check that the week will check.
So, just summarizing in a sense the quarter, it was quite a rough quarter. It's often the case that quarter four is a challenging quarter. It's come just normally after the Christmas rush, which tends to boost spending and therefore GDP a little bit. Normally have a slump, but this one was quite sharp. This one was quite sharp, and honorable members will see that real GDP contracted by an annualized 1.2%. And the most significant contractions on the production side was in mining and agriculture. There was some growth, and it's indicated principally in private services, both the normal services as well as wholesale and retail trade, and in government. It was a relatively modest, a very welcome expansion in manufacturing. And members will see that inflation was just outside the target range, with food inflation being quite a key driver as a result of the drought. We wanted to pull out and look under the aggregates that's in the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. So when we look at it, honorable members will see CPI for the poorest 20% of South Africans was 8.1%, compared to just under 6% for the wealthiest 20% of the population. And that's important because very often when inflation statistics are published, there is a sense of disbelief about its accuracy. That's because it's an average. It aggregates many, many people, in fact 55 million people's experience in the market. And so it's useful from time to break that up and see who is affected, to what extent. The job story was also very, very challenging. The unemployment rate went up. 355,000 jobs were lost quarter to quarter, and total jobs decreased below the 16 million level that briefly reached in December last year. And you'll see the breakdown by province. halting at quite significant job losses, and most of job losses occurred in trade, which is somewhat understandable. It's just after the crisp rush, as I say. But the extent of it was quite sharp. Manufacturing lost significant jobs, as did construction, on a quarter-to-quarter basis. We've also looked in gender and youth numbers so that we can see what is the implications, the impact on many participants in our labor market that are often in more vulnerable positions. So we see a growth in unemployment rate in the first quarter for both men and women, and we see the enormous challenge with youth unemployment. So this is last year we had quite a dramatic rise in employment. And then suddenly we have one quarter where it comes down very, very sharply. It's not typical for employment statistics to show such wide swings. The programs are known. Program one, we report on the unqualified audit work that we were doing for the audit that will be tabled shortly in Parliament. Then we go to objective two, which is on the jobs drivers, and work on implementing the NGP and the economic strategy in support of the National Development Plan. And members will see there the work. One of the key areas was to try to work on a better impact assessment modality. As they say, and the big question in any society is who guards guards? And in the same way, how do you make sure that your assessment systems are properly able to assess. You have weak assessment systems, it can give you the results that are not helpful for policy. So we've done a lot of work with something called DISAM, which is the Dynamic Social Accounting Matrix. It's used internationally by the major UN agency that looks at social employment impact globally. And we've done a bit of training now to get us the state to understand how to rigorously use DISAM. Some of the work covered agriculture, there's a scoping of work in Limpopo, but also a bit of work on the National Agriculture and Agro-Processing Dashboard. We report on slide 10 on some of the work in Limpopo, including literally a physical mapping of where climatic conditions favor particular product value chains, and there's also a snapshot of employment and GDP in Limpopo. That map sets out in the blue. It's a set of products that DAP had identified. We think more work now needs to be done to turn these from concepts into implementation. From the National Agriculture Dashboard, honorable members will see that total employment in agriculture was just short of 900,000. And employment in agro-processing was a further 300, just over 300,000. And we then provide a little bit of a feel of what happened in the subsectors of agriculture. Social economy, the more significant work in this quarter was finalizing the arrangements with the government of Flanders for a, call it a 6 million rand donation or grant that they've made available for us to do some work on the social economy to try to promote inclusive growth. The big story in this quarter, if I look at the main one, is probably the steel industry. And we make the point in slide 14 that the new growth path, jobs driver on manufacturing, relies heavily on the steel value chain. But we have two jobs drivers that are important. The one is mineral beneficiation. If you think of South Africa's mineral wealth, we are not insignificant producer of iron ore. And actually, if you look at all the main minerals, the two that we most consistently beneficiate are coal, which is really what Eskom and Sasol uses, and iron ore, which goes into the steel value chain. The global economic environment in this quarter remained difficult for resource-rich economies, with sharply low commodity prices and a decline in global demand, coupled with a glut oversupply of major producers. And we point to China as a real driver of this. As China shifted away from a massive focus on infrastructure to more balanced economic growth, balanced and low economic growth, that led to a decline in the demand for steel products. And what it really means, somebody is going to blink and close the steel mills because that's the only way in which an overproduction crisis can be addressed. And the unfavorable set of circumstances led the department, working with the DTI and the steel industry, to develop a comprehensive package of measures to support South Africa's primary steel production capabilities. Some of this will come up in the current quarter, and that was quarter two's report. When you bring quarter two's report, we're going to be looking at the impact of the agreement between AMSA and the competition authorities. So these things happen in real time, and now we're talking about something that happened from January to March. We're already in September, and of course events enrich and sometimes overtake what we say. But these are the many interventions in this quarter. Included the following. We had ministerial level meetings with stakeholders. We met the CEOs and we said to them, what are the challenges? What are your price points? What do you need to be able to survive? We set up an intergovernmental task team to bring together the different instruments. And whilst it's not absolutely perfect, it was quite an interesting example with steel that we've begun to bring together a trade component, a competition component, and an industrial investment component. We put in a bit of capacity for ITAC to monitor implementation of the scrap metal policy in this period. ITAC also increased the rate of customs duties to 10% for certain products, and there was an engagement on principles for flat steel pricing in South Africa to ensure that the companies that use raw steel benefit from these, and in fact that we don't focus on saving ArcelorMittal at the expense of the downstream users. What a difficult balancing act. And then we continue to implement the price preference system on scrap metal. Basically, there the storyline is that historically South Africa used most of its scrap metal locally. Over the last, I guess, decade or so, it began to be exported much more substantially. That led to shortages and challenges domestically, and we put in place a plan. So there are six key interventions on the steel side. Moving on, we did a bit of work on support for the Free State, a workshop with Free State to mobilize the national GFIs to see how we can support industrialization in Free State, as a province is really falling behind on the industrialization stakes. And some of the constraints were highlighted. So GFIs were open and said, look, these are the problems we're facing. And the outcome was that an existing business assessment committee would also invite national departments to take part in it to see if we can unlock project funding. There's a little snapshot there of the big numbers for the Free State. Moving on to Mpumalanga, the work that the department did in this quarter, in fact, all of the provincial work was led by the deputy minister, not just this one, Free State, Limpopo, and the engagements at municipal level. And EDD supported the province to develop their Mpumalanga Industrial Development Plan. And in this quarter itself, we worked with them to align the MIDP with national policies and plans and try to get a bit more concrete so that trying to develop a document is not seen as the end of work. It's really just a set of ideas in a disciplined form of what needs to be done. In the table right below, the outcome of the work focused on specific areas in Mpumalanga and where there was potential comparative advantage, where they could focus their areas. So in Middelburg, for example, obviously metals manufacturing, Secunda is the country, in fact, the continent's big petrochem hub. And so the idea would be, can you build on that? You can't have a clean sheet of paper and just develop an industrial plan on it. You've got to look at where you have opportunities. Moving on, there was a bit of work on mine town intervention. The closure of Evra Hyrel Steel and Vanadium works in Malahleni and the iron ore mine resulted in a contraction in that local economy. We facilitated the unblocking of a program in the province at meetings and looked at where are alternative efforts, because if you if you can't stop a place from closing or downsizing, what else can you do to stimulate growth? And DM may well speak later in the discussion part on the issues, but we really did hold the summit and to have a clear plan around job creation, growth, poverty alleviation. That program, of course, as a whole is driven by DPME, so we come in with an ED dimension to it. The next area is program two. There's one indicator, and in this quarter, there's something we report on that indicator. We've reported quite a bit in the previous three quarters on that. Program three deals with a number of KPIs, and these are then reported on specifically. Slide 21 deal with the cabinet-level reports. We produce 18 reports which identified progress as well as actions cabinet needed to consider. And the report tracked about 190,000 jobs in the National Infrastructure Program. We did work also on unblocking matters. Quite a bit of the work in this quarter was to try to land a loan from the BRICS New Development Bank for Eskom to be able to build transmission lines to connect renewable energy plants to the national grid. So these are not the old renewable energy plants. These are the new ones. And given the challenges on Eskom's balance sheet, the big one of the big factors that may delay the renewable energy program is the inability to get the infrastructure aligned. So it's quite important for us to get this work done. We also supported the unblocking of a 46 million rand funding shortfall for the Mpumalanga University Road, and it will enable construction of the road to proceed. Very often when you have a mega project, it's all the support infrastructure where people had very optimistic views about funding or technical capability, and those come apart. So your main project is where the engineers focus, and so a lot of our work, as honorable members will see, is often connecting things, filling something that someone has not focused on. The cabinet also approved that work be done to identify and accelerate construction start dates on the large infrastructure projects, going water, transport, energy, health and education, and we did quite a bit of work, particularly in January for the cabinet in Gautla, that looked and received very detailed reports on all of this. The PICC itself had three secretariat meetings and four management committee meetings in that period. This is where ministers and deputy ministers go through raw information on the different infrastructure projects and the challenges there. On the localization on the infrastructure program, the IDC received a few referrals on possibilities and opportunities that they go through the IDC processes, and they have to be evaluated in terms of their protocols. We also held engagements with state-owned companies to drive areas where we could localize the supply of components. And we looked at the key products procured by state-owned companies to see how we can localize. Again, there are two components to it. One is an industrialization one, but the other one, as we've seen with some of the procurements from abroad, the challenges often inherent in it are enormous. So if we can keep on building a competitive, solid local industry that can supply the infrastructure program, it may address certainly some, if not all, of those problems. On the investment side, we unblocked a few investment ones. The one that's perhaps worth noting is the Canara Bank. Bank based in India approached us, said that they had experienced difficulty in securing a license from the Reserve Bank. We spoke to National Treasury. Treasury said absolutely no problem with this thing, let's unblock it. A lot of things are like that. The system just often needs a little bit of a push to get things moving. ArcelorMittal, we covered that previously. On the capacity of economic regulators, we did a review of the capacity and role of the regulators with survey results indicating where mandates are potentially overlapping and what the gaps are in the skills base of the regulators. And we looked at vacancy rates, where the regulators were achieving the objectives. And one of the things that came out of it is that certainly we're going to need a lot more systematic training for regulators on cross-cutting areas. So in cross-cutting areas, excessive pricing, or essentially where markets work well, pricing is hit by markets. In other words, people refuse to pay high prices, the producer has to bring down their price, and so you get competitive prices. As long as you have a couple of competitors, the system works. If for any reason you have a market characterized by features which inhibit competition, you have one main player, or the nature of the product is such that it's a natural monopoly, then regulators have to step in. The challenge regulators face is, what is a fair return? And so in economic theory, in competition policy globally, the notion of excessive pricing is there. Is a player abusing its position, its dominant position, or even its monopoly position, to impose prices on customers and downstream users? So we did some work here. We had a workshop bringing together regulators from the Competition Commission, the Tribunal, the National Energy Regulator, the Communications Regulator, as well as outside players like Genesis Analytics and the Center for Competition Regulation and Economic Development at the University of Johannesburg, and started to unpack what does excessive pricing mean as a concept in our law. And this also flows, as honorable members may recall, from the judgment by Dennis Davis, the JP of the Competition Appeal Court, in the Sasol matter. We did a bit of work looking of judges on the scrap metal court case, and this slide sets out the history of this. We opposed the application that a company had brought to challenge the price reference system, and the judgment that we received from the Cape High Court upheld the decision of the minister to issue the price reference system directive, and it also found that IPAC did not commit an error of law when it refused to grant the dealer permits outside the price preferences. This is a fourth court case that has been brought, because these are quite deep-pocketed litigants, and in fact the matter is now going on appeal. Slide 53 deals with the illicit trading in scrap metal, and a little bit of work on a risk engine to track illicit scrap metal exports, and working with SARS and IDAC and the scrap metal industry to reduce illicit trade in scrap metal. Slide 34 deals with the engagement of trade competition authorities, and honorable members will see the details in there. Then we've also produced information on the Q4 financials, and these follow from page 36 onwards, the DG is available to take the information, but the summary of it, honorable members will see that the department and its entities have spent 883 million out of 885 million. That's 99.7% of the total allocated budget. That the bulk of the money is made up of transfers, and the rest of the quarterly data is set out on page 37, which goes into the detail of budget, year-to-date, the variance, and spend percentages. That continues on the next slide with the details set out, and then the next two slides similarly provides the information, and that was pre-circulated to members of the committee last week. And then on slide 41, we deal with some of the variances dealing with compensation of employees, goods and services, where there's a little bit of a spike because a lot of the lawyers' bills for the matter that we deal with get sent by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. So a bit of a jump here. And then the Operation Mining Pakisa, where a fair bit of the work was done in the period from July, December last year, the bills came in, and of course the BRICS competition conference that was held in December last year. There's a note here on transfers and subsidies, and on the capital assets, the procurement of the DISAM software from the ILO. So that chairperson sets out the first 3 months of the year and what we would seek to do for the guidance that the chairperson has given is move immediately to quarter one and where necessary just pull out some overlaps. So quarter one, I'll go a little bit more slowly through because it's a more recent period. And
the minister wanted to say the last 4 months of the...
Oh, did I mangle my words?
Yes.
Okay, thanks for that.
Okay.
So this one, this quarter deals with the first 3 months of the new financial year of the new APP. It covers the period from April to June, and that's what we mean in this report with the word quarter one. If I had to ask, if I had to summarize a very lengthy report, that slide shows what are the most significant things we can just pull out. Of course, there's the standard report on the KPIs and the economic and employment review. And we're doing a little bit of a focus on the fourth industrial revolution. And Honorable Atkinson will recall his request in previous discussions that we dig a little bit deeper into it. Competition policy, again, it's a matter that has come up from a number of honorable members that there's been much discussion on the issue. I have had questions and comments from Honorable Kiani as well as Honorable Cardo, so I'm going to just open it a little bit. The youth enterprise and investment issues, we've taken a little bit of a focus on trade policy, and then finally a focus on human resources in the department itself, besides all the Senate reports. So the economic context for the quarter from April to June, the economy recovered fairly robustly. Annualized growth was 3.3% after the contraction of the previous quarter. And what was particularly useful is that we had a strong recovery in mining and manufacturing. As I indicated in a statement I made in the House, we're not out of boots. It's not as if one quarter can give us the comfort that we're not under enormous pressure. We've got to feel that pressure, we've got to recognize it, and keep on doing the right things and focusing on the right things. Honorable members will see that the recovery has been somewhat more export-oriented or export-supported, and of course the weaker rand has assisted. But investment levels remain weak. Inflation was at 6.3%, but you'll see the continuing much larger impact of inflationary pressures on the poor. And this, of course, the single biggest item that we've drawn attention to is food inflation. Unemployment, while the jobs losses was lower in the quarter, there were still job losses. And obviously, we're going to be looking now for the employment recovery. The good news was that 67,000 jobs were created in manufacturing. Gauteng, in the last quarter, was the biggest loser of jobs. This quarter, it was the biggest gainer of jobs, the biggest new job creation on a net basis was in Gauteng. And in this quarter, the largest number of jobs were lost in the Western Cape, about 90,000, which accounted for roughly half the job losses in the country. So quite a sharp contraction in the Western Cape figures. Unemployment was marginally better, but we'd need to do a lot more before we can really be pleased with it. And total jobs decreased quarter to quarter by 129,000. It was quite a few interesting anomalies that the data shows us from time to time. In this case, we saw a big decrease in the size of the labor force. Not because people say they are discouraged, not because they say, look, we're looking for, or we're prepared to work, but we've given up. There are people who say, we're not working, we're not looking for work, we're not discouraged either. The youth unemployment rate decreased marginally, and the unemployment rate for women decreased marginally. Under administration, we report on the preparatory work for the audit. Of course, this was the big audit quarter, and it will be also in the second quarter. And from the work that we did with the Auditor General, we want to refine some of the technical indicators that the department uses to interpret what is required on the APP. Heading to program two on the jobs issues, I attended the World Economic Forum session in Kigali in Rwanda in May this year under the theme Connecting Africa's Resources Through Digital Transformation, with a government delegation but also a fairly significant business delegation. Some of the areas that I have particularly focused on, I have meetings with domestic and foreign investors on the South African economic environment. These are companies who are either there already or are looking at coming into South Africa. We had a plenary discussion on Africa and the Fourth Industrial Revolution, as well as meetings with other African leaders on the continent's development agenda, and a discussion on Africa's pathways to transformation. In other words, where are we at with agriculture or manufacturing or infrastructure as key drivers of change? The implications of the Fourth Industrial Revolution for the continent and therefore for South Africa are profound, and we're going to need to open up this discussion, much as we're focusing right now on short to medium term challenges. But the long term is being made now, and it's being made now in quite a dramatic way. So opening up under the bonnet of this term, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, industrial revolutions, as honorable members will know, normally refer to quite an abrupt and radical change to an economy. And arguably one of the biggest revolutions in human history was the agrarian revolution, where human beings moved from hunting animals to actually beginning to develop settled communities, planting, looking after capital, domesticating wild beasts and making them domesticated animals that can be looked after and can, on a more predictable basis, support human development. That was 10,000 years ago. In our more immediate time frame, the big issue has been what economists and economic historian refers to as the Industrial Revolution. And that's the thing that often in these three textbooks is periodized as being from the mid-1700s to the mid-1800s, maybe late 1800s, where we moved from a rural society, the world, increasingly to one where urbanization, factory production, all of that became the big drivers of growth. I make the point here that the world did not experience this in a unified way. While Europe was getting involved with a spinning jenny, large numbers of Africans, for example, were shifted from the west coast of the continent to be slaves in cotton plantations in North America. So these revolutions don't affect us in the same way. They affect different parts of the world in very, very different ways. And we make the point here that Africa's experience of the early industrial revolution was through colonial conquest to gain access to raw materials for production. Even today, there are still billions of people in the world that are not yet even in fully in the first industrial revolution, let alone the fourth. But we make that point because that's how development is. It's uneven, and smart policy making is not to critique those things only, but to see how do we shape it and where do we find opportunity. So in the World Economic Forum in Davos in January, quite a lot of thinking, discussion, and so on was on what is called the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And so what the economic historians in Davos did was they divided Industrial Revolution into three phases, and then they talked of the fourth phase. The first one was mechanical production, which was simply trying to get steam engines and so on to do the work that human beings used to do. And then that moved qualitatively up with mass production, when electricity and the factory assembly line took that concept to absolutely new heights. In our age, it's been the digital revolution with the development of semiconductors, mainframe computing that used to be filling a room like this not too long ago, 25, 30 years ago. The power on this computer that I'm using now would probably have taken this entire room. I remember the mainframe at UCT filling exactly a room this size and giving computing power that you can have in a little unit like this today. And of course, the internet, that's really fundamentally transformed everything. What's new is artificial intelligence and smart production. And it's so significant that the theorists are telling us that in our lifetime, something so big is happening that we need to see it. It's like a wave coming at us, and it's going to change how our children experience the economy. So I'm going to just turn to that, and by the fourth industrial revolution, they refer really to the economic and technological trends that are maturing to what they call tipping points. Let me give an example. If 2% of South Africa uses computers, then it's not a major driver of the economy. But when you get to a tipping point, the tipping point may be 60%, as an example, then suddenly that technology changes the life of everybody. You can see among young people today, social media, it just completely altered the way in which news is consumed, the way in which networking takes place. Now, in the work that's been done on the 14th Industrial Revolution, they've identified 21, actually 23, but they call it 21 tipping point, where they say they expect in the next 10 years such big change that the world is going to change in the way that they understand it. And I've identified a few. So the first one is 3D printing. Now, 3D printing is quite a fascinating thing. It's a machine like this, and I'm sure some members have seen it. And essentially, it manufactures things through layered printing. So essentially, it can take plastics, you know, your polymer, you put it into the machine, and by layering it, it can produce this bottle. Or this little gadget here. And you can, in theory, put any input into it. It's at an early stage now, although there's an increasing range of things, but if it really takes off, it can transform manufacturing completely. Some are saying that this may well mean that big economies that have outsourced their work to cheaper labor locations will source their work back in, that the United States may become again a big manufacturing producer because machines, digital 3D printing will do cheaper in the United States what currently the Chinese worker is doing. If that happens, and no one can really predict because of that, a lot will depend on how the innovation, where innovation takes us to. You can see how significant a factor that will be in global industrial development. A second big one is advanced robotics. I saw a robot, Chairperson and honorable members, that was sitting like a human being. He got up, one of the scientists had a tin of Coke. The robot took the Coke, emptied the Coke, crushed the can, left the can, walked, picked up a newspaper, sat with a newspaper like that, had cameras that could take the information in the newspaper and interpret it. So in other words, you see now more and more a lot of the flexibility that human beings have brought into the world through this amazing tool that's the human body is now being replicated by scientists. So what we used to think is just for the movies, you know, with robots and so on, is suddenly for the first time becoming technologically feasible. Not as a small little thing, but something that is really changing. Now, what that means is where human labor used to be important, robotics will take over. So you can have entire factories run by robots in the future. Think of what that means for employment. The third one is driverless cars and the constant use of industrial drones. Currently, Google has got a number of cars in the United States that have no driver sitting behind the wheel. They've got a human being sitting next to in the other seat just for federal, because the American law requires it. But the car drives itself. Tesla's got one. There's a couple of companies. And they're clocking up billions of miles where the car drives without the driver. So all you do is you pop in where you want to go, and it's got sensors all around, and it looks at the truck coming there, and at the car behind you, and that pedestrian that's crossing the road, and it makes better judgment calls than most human drivers. So in future, if I want to leave home and come to Parliament and be there on time, I will hop into a driverless vehicle. And this is the future of so much of human movement in the cities. So it's already, this is not an idea in a book. It actually is there. And I say millions of miles have been clocked up at the moment. And drones, of course, drones have become very famous because of its use in war. But drones are also being used for many, many other purposes. So agricultural applications. Instead of people doing things, these drones now give you information. It's like little, little things that fly all over. And it just absorbs huge amounts of information. And it centralizes that information. Then it's new materials used in production. Increasingly, scientists are working on materials that are lighter and thinner and stronger. There are some amazing stories of materials that will transform all the gadgets that we have. But even more significant is artificial intelligence that thinks. If you think of any a computer, its thinking, if you want to call it thinking, is really the view of the software writer. It's nothing more than a machine that just implements what the software writer said it must do. New machines are different. They're working on what they call fuzzy logic and where the machine learns from doing things. You already see a little bit just on a small scale. If you type in, if I want to type in economic development in Google and I spell the word economic wrong and I write economic, then it will spell correct. It pulls in itself, but this is not what we'd be looking for. There isn't the word economic. So it then uses intelligence to tell you, hang on, you know, you've got that fingers here, you've slipped, you've put a P instead of a C or something. Now that's on a small scale. What artificial intelligence, and I'm going to come back to it, what it's going to do is change the way in which the world operates. Because computers can think. It, some things it can think better than human beings. And I'll illustrate that in a moment. Then there's neurotechnologies. Neurotechnologies are when things are implanted in the brain. So at my age, one of the big challenges my generation faces is we forget things. We forget where we left our keys, but we also forget economic data. And the question is whether an external hard drive becomes part of what human beings do. Again, if we had raised this 5 years ago, it would have been, but you know, that science fiction. Suddenly, technology is advancing to the point where it's no longer so unimaginable. 40 years ago, I would not have believed if someone said, everybody in that I know will have a little gadget that they walk with that can play movies and can send messages and so on. Today, what's the big deal? And with neurotechnologies, some implantable technologies, you may well find on the board clearly that the next generation will have a tattoo. And the tattoo will be electronic signals. So you can actually, your SIM card is embedded in your body. And as easy as a tattoo is, just they do it. So the world is changing, and this is where new sources of jobs, development, wealth creation lies. There's constant connectivity. There's already quite a bit of work on getting the internet embedded in your clothes, that your clothes become communication tools, connected homes, and the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is what they refer to the connectivity of your fridge and your stove and your cupboard, where that can already work out when you're short of milk and when you're short of cheese and so on. It can send information to Pick and Pay. You have an account there. All of that is then put in a little basket and it's sent to your house. So all of that, which defines so much of our humanness, now becomes automated and taken out of what we do day by day. Smart cities, they've now worked on creative cities where there are no robots, for example, when I say traffic lights, because so much of it is now just technology. It works out what time you leave home to be able to avoid traffic jams and so on. Crowdsourcing is quite an incredible idea where you get thousands of people to collaborate on an idea. At the moment, crowdsourcing is mainly used to raise money. If I've got a great idea, I put the idea on the internet and people give $5 or 50 rand or something, and if the thing takes off, they get some benefit from it. But if you take ideas, say this presentation, if I could crowdsource this presentation yesterday, I have no doubt it would be enormously better if lots of people, even outside the state, could have worked on it. If you think about the invention of new things, when you can harness the ideas of so many millions of people across the world, we are really at the point where we can take off in big ways. And finally, there's something called big data. Big data is when companies can take enormous amounts of information about us that they gain from Facebook and Google and our medical aids and everything, and they can begin to see, for example, I attended a session where they said disease management and particularly epidemics, flu epidemics and so on, can be a thing of the past if big data can be harnessed. Traffic, for example, can be a thing of the past if you can harness big data. Moving on to what this will mean. First, if I would take the legal industry, at the moment lawyers, a large number of lawyers, many will say too many, but contract writing can be done by software more effectively than it can by a human lawyer. The medical profession, a lot of the routine things will be, now your phone can serve as a diagnostic tool. It's very early yet, but you'll see large numbers of lawyers and doctors and nurse and certain kinds of nursing staff could be laid off because technology will do an even better job than we can do ourselves. Engineering is another example where many of the coordinates, if known, get plugged into software and you get a better bridge design than a human being can. I haven't put politicians in there, but clearly they, yeah. Social impact. The social impact on this would be quite significant. We're becoming older as societies because people are going to live longer. They say now that children born currently in Europe and the United States and Japan, at least 25% of them are going to live to 100. At least 25%. It used to be a rare thing, but in England you got a telegram from the Queen. In South Africa, your family gathers around you and make a big fuss if you're 100, because it's really bad. It will become the norm in our generation. In other words, the kids being born now. Obviously, in poor countries, the challenge of malaria, HIV, AIDS, poverty, and all the illnesses of poverty still means that the mortality rates will still not be like that. So you'll have an increase in gap between wealthy people and societies and poorer ones. All of these will begin to feature in future. Work will change. Will you still work? Now, in all the previous phases of the Industrial Revolution, it destroys work and it creates new work. The theorists are now saying for the first time they wonder whether this Industrial Revolution will create more work. Their bet at the moment is it will destroy more work than it will create. Because intelligence is the big thing that human beings never gave up before. Now it will be better. Machines will do a better job. What skills you require will change dramatically. What we're teaching at universities and Tibet colleges today may be irrelevant in the economy 20 to 30 years from now. Just like if you taught people to be typists when typewriters are no longer a big thing. Innovation becomes much more important. We always say we've got platinum, we've got iron ore, we've got this and that. But the Industrial Revolution can change what kind of materials you need. So it means a well-endowed economy like South Africa could almost overnight lose the value of it. Or it may well be that manganese has so many new applications that the value of it goes up. We don't know. We're at the edge of uncertainty about the future. The macroeconomic effects, if you have this massive supply of goods and services, but machines don't buy things, who's going to buy it? So from a macroeconomic point, if the macroeconomists are worried that we're going to create a massive supply and no demand. And then finally, the growing social inequities within nations and between nations. Then we look at our policy responses. The new growth path, when it was adopted in 2010, identified 10 jobs drivers, and we said one of these knowledge-based sectors, which means accelerating technological change, new opportunities in biotechnology, nanotechnology, and so on. And we identified four things at the time that we needed to do, four elements: more spending on research and development, better access and use of ICT, better adaptation of technologies and quickly moving it into all spheres of life, and trying to maintain the technological edge in knowledge-based sectors. So what this means practically is that in the new environment, successful industrializers will be defined by the ability to develop new technologies and bring these to market rapidly and scale them up. I don't know how many of the honorable members remember technology called Mixit. When it was first launched, it was actually cutting edge. It was one of the best technologies anywhere in the world I know of. It was not scaled up. It played in the junior league. And WhatsApp scaled up rapidly, started off less sophisticated than Mixit. Today it is the standard. So when you've got great ideas, because you're in a global market, it no longer is only how good your idea is. It's can you scale it up, and can you use the income you get from it constantly to innovate and overtake all of your competitors. So we've identified four areas: basic research, how do we work with universities and the labs of large companies, like Cecil, for example, to get ideas quicker to market and to get better ideas generated. Then there's scaling up. And finally, skills development. Trying to learn dates of when this happened in history, 1652, 1789, becomes unimportant when Google is a touch away. So what we learn becomes a lot more important. We used to put a lot of focus on technical standards, just try to produce things technically well, be a good welder, be a good brick player and so on. Now, of course, in the next 10, 15 years, it's still important. But if more and more of that will be done by machines in future, what will give human beings the edge? And increasingly, it's problem-solving rather than load learning. It's creativity rather than simply replicating what's in front of you. The IDC has put some investment in new technologies from using the isotopes for nuclear, the nuclear isotopes for medicine, to the low-dox machine that I've spoken of previously in the committee, the K-ray machine, and so on. Government will need to invest more in math, science, and problem-solving skills, but there's another part to it. And it's quite an interesting touch. If economies will become more service-based, then soft skills like language skills become a lot more important. So in the past, we've emphasized maths and science, rightly so, and we said there's too much focus on the humanities. The irony of global change is that the humanities may again be more important as you go forward. It's less likely that machines will become good psychologists. It's more likely that machines will become good engineers. So these are the things that we need to try to think through. I've taken a bit of time here, Chair, because this is really very future-oriented stuff. And as they say, you know, you've got to build the future today. It's not something that waits for itself to come. Moving on then, slide 40, we deal with jobs and public policy advocacy. The NDP says we've got to focus on active use of competition policy to open markets and achieve public policy outcomes. And here we report on a policy advocacy workshop with unions covering how does the regulatory processes work. And we had unions in communications, retail and hospitality, and chemicals and energy. Now, the Act specifically provides for union involvement, but we haven't had as many unions becoming involved because of the skills challenge. And we make the point here, in order to achieve the integration of the NGP's prescript and competition policy, trade unions need to be empowered to take on the responsibilities they have. We also produced an in-house indicators bulletin, an economic indicators bulletin, that looked at the prices of infrastructure wage goods. And there's a little table on the next slide that says, for example, on electricity for the period of the survey, the price increased above inflation. The impact on the society is negative for something like that, and that gets passed through to the consumer. On the other hand, the price of petrol, which is also a regulated price, decreased over this period, and it has a positive impact. So we looked at it as quite an interesting little bulletin, and it's more work will be done to improve quality control and so on, so that we can eventually publish these bulletins. We did a bit of work on an IBC investment in Ethiopia, a cement company, building a state-of-the-art cement plant, which helps to industrialize other parts of the African continent and helps in with the overall storyline that if we can grow the continent, we're well positioned to benefit from that growth. And so this just sets out the details of my work with the Minister of Finance to improve the support for that project. Of course, we're going to be getting all of our money back and the return on it, but we need to put that money in. The next one is mining and beneficiation. I've covered in the previous quarter quite a bit on steel. Here we set up a steel pricing committee, and this is a committee of ITAC to monitor and make recommendations to ITAC. And essentially what it does is, because we increase tariffs, there's every possibility that the upstream steel makers can abuse their position and just pass massive costs to the downstream users. So we need hard information. When are they doing that, and what can we do about it? So this committee brings together not just upstream players, but also many of the downstream users who can then monitor the prices. The next area that we did a bit of work on in KPI 4 was tariff support for local farmers, and we applied the tariff formula that currently is on the tariff book is sensitive to movements in the exchange rates. So, of course, we want to support farmers during a difficult period with a drought and help them to manage, because their cost of production goes up when they don't have a ready-made supply of water. This also helps with food security. But on the other hand, high food prices, as we saw with food inflation, drives up prices for the poor. So trying to find this balance is quite important. So I issued a directive to ITAC to review the current domestic reference price and the formula for wheat, maize and sugar, that I'm not convinced that we've got the right balance between keeping food prices low and supporting the farming community. So hopefully that work that ITAC does will shed a bit more light into what has happened here. We've put now into these products the significance, so you'll see in the number of cases we talk about the significance. Here we say both initiatives monitor the impact of trade policy on sectors regarded as jobs drivers in the NGP, steel in mining, wheat, maize and sugar in agriculture, and then the work on regional economic development talks obviously to the African regional integration jobs driver. The AG has drawn my attention to the fact that often the department don't connect the dots well. They do work when we explain it verbally. The AG sees immediately the connection between the work and the APPs. But they want us to record this much more and clarify what that link is. And so more of this will be done. Moving to KPI 6, this is on youth access to entrepreneurship opportunities. There was some work done by the Deputy Minister and some work done by the RTC. In slide 20, we talk about the youth entrepreneurial dialogue with a National Youth Chamber that Deputy Minister co-hosted, and it presented a progress report on newly identified entrepreneurial initiatives by youth, and it showcased a spaza shop revitalization concept, a project with the electricity mobile maintenance franchise, and a central database portal for young entrepreneurs. And the outcome is intended to be increased access for youth entrepreneurship. The National Youth Business Chamber work I've described. I should also indicate that the IEC in this quarter approved 21.9 million rand for youth and youth-empowered businesses, and it began on its youth pipeline development program. Essentially, the IEC said to us, we've got money, young people are not coming forward enough. We've said to them, help solve that problem. Don't lament. Create a pipeline and bring people into the pipeline. And as colleagues will see, honorable members, the program is intended to have an aggressive marketing campaign attached to it. IC approvals. In this slide, on the left-hand side, we put together IEC approvals for youth-empowered businesses from 2011 right through to when we signed the Youth Employment Accord in Soweto to today. And you will see, honorable members, we used to give a poll to 58 million rand just 5 years ago to youth empowered businesses. Today it's 970 million per year. So it's quite a big jump year on year, and it's one of the more significant things we can point to. And there is a little picture of the IBC's publication on youth entrepreneurship. Going to KPI 7, which is on provincial initiatives, we did work with the development of the Northern Cape Provincial Economic Development Blueprint. Details are set there. And for the Northern Cape, the big story is mining is dominant, and they've got to diversify into other areas. For a period, Northern Cape benefited from renewable energy, good, construction, all of that, but frankly, the long-term job implication of solar and wind plants are relatively modest. So you need to focus on agro processing and working on getting the SKA corridor much better. In fact, the SKA thing is something that perhaps we should put on the slides next time. It's a big opportunity. So it's really just seeing how can you localize economic development in the Northern Cape beyond the boost that renewable energy gave. In Mpumalanga, the Deputy Minister worked with municipalities, academics and others to mobilize around the 9-point plan and the development of Mpumalanga's Provincial Economic Development Plan. And then we move to the KPI 8, which is social dialogue, industrial relations and so on. Now there were four big areas we focused on in this quarter, only one which we provide detail on because of time. The first one, we had meetings with organized business and labor with the presidency to identify common actions to reignite growth in South Africa. So CEOs of all the large corporations sat with us to see what can be done. Kostatu, Natu, Fedusa came into the discussion to see what labor could do. Secondly, we met with individual social partners to talk about industrial relations matters. For example, is there an openness to a social pact on wages, jobs, investment, and inequality? Thirdly, we engage at NEDLAC on the national minimum wage and the country's industrial relations framework. And finally, we did some review of the provisions of the Youth Employment Accord, and I'm going to focus on this fourth one in the next slide or two. So next slide, slide 26, says there were three activities on this one front that we did. I provided a review of the contents and impact of the Youth Employment Accord at the National Youth Parliament, convening Klipan in Soweto in June, and it was in fact organized by Parliament. So I was invited by Parliament. Secondly, we provided feedback on the new National Youth Service Program that's being developed. And third, Deputy Minister engaged at local level on a number of initiatives, which we'll come to in a moment. On the National Youth Parliament, we provided the Youth Parliament with a brief summary of the Youth Employment Accord. The chairperson was present at the Youth Parliament. There have been other members of Parliament who were present. We looked at the impact in areas such as youth employment, funding for youth entrepreneurship, skills development, and public initiatives of youth empowerment. And then it was an engagement with young leaders who took the issues on, asked some tough questions, and it gave us an opportunity to even explain how the Economic Development Portfolio Committee works and how, why it's open to young people to approach the Portfolio Committee. And by this, we did a practical review of the Youth Employment Accord. Instead of asking an academic to do it, we asked young people what is their experience of it. In the green box, Jefferson, we make the point that during the course of the Youth Parliament, I was presented with two gifts by Parliament, very generous gifts. The one was a T-shirt, quite a beautiful T-shirt, and the other one was a beanie, which in a cold Soweto morning is very welcome. And I was very appreciative of that.
Of course, given our mandate, I turned the T-shirt around and looked at the label. And the label of origin said, Made in China. And I brought that to the attention of the Speaker of Parliament. And it's not just Parliament, it's endlessly we see the gap between policy and implementation, even in political parties, even in trade unions, not just in the state, that we all have, I think, very good goals and intentions, but it's a systematic implementation that's important. I thought I should just make that little point. The Deputy Minister did quite a bit of work. We don't put all of it here, but just to summarize some of the more significant ones, is he worked with a youth dialogue in Ermelo, 40 young leaders, and talked to them about their experience at the local level on the Youth Employment Court, and the department also facilitated the signing of an MOU between the Gert Sibande and the Beth College in Sasol to develop skills relevant to the working world. And then, while it's still in the cabinet process, so we're not yet releasing it, but one of the departments of government is working on a national youth service program framework, and we did a bit of work pointing to the experience of the Youth Employment Accord, what to do, what not to do, and that work is ongoing. Turning next to competition, trade, and investment issues, we started with the infrastructure. We did 18 construction update reports. Okay, financial data, employment, localization. We showed where construction was taking place and where they stalled, and we identified progress and actions the cabinet needed to consider to ensure the infrastructure build program was implemented and able to boost jobs and growth. Specifically on the infrastructure side, in slide 31, cabinet requested the PICC to identify the challenges with new infrastructure. And during the quarter, we did quite a bit of work on it, and we said, what limits us from moving as fast as we can? Some of this was funding, some of capacity to implement, and some of policy gaps. We did a bit of work looking at the international experience of one large company with what they call the project factory approach, and now beginning to pilot it. And we did work on a proposed new technical project management team. One of the problems with many of the big mega projects is it's left to a line department. So the line department does the work, announces it, and then we discover once we started the scope was inappropriate. So then they change the scope, and it just adds billions to the project. Or you find that the geological work was inadequate, and so the foundation of a massive project is unstable, and you discover it 3 or 4 years into the whole program. So we want to bring more rigor. So this is a joint project between National Treasury and ourselves to try to, as it were, deepen the technical capability before funding is approved. So that it's not just an entity in a line department, but now begin to bring Treasury and PICC into the sphere. And we also did a briefing on the National Infrastructure Plan to NEDLAC, to business, labor, and community organizations. 3 secretariat meetings, 1 Manco, and we tabled 1 cabinet memorandum in this period. We also had some work done on SIP 5, which is one that I specifically chair. Got updates on the raising of the Clanwilliam Dam wall, the Sultana Industrial Development Zone, and we facilitated the transfer of land that's moved quite far in the last number of months between IDC and the Industrial Development Zone, and we encourage Transnet to also do some work to get their land leased to the Industrial Development Zone. And sometimes energy construction work we reviewed on the supply of storage in Sultana for the Western Cape market. Turning next to investment as a whole, in slide 35 we identify 5 areas of work within this quarter. Only one of us willing to report on in detail, again because of time. So the first one was we had meetings with investors. For example, I met with businesses in Iran during the state visit in this quarter to look at what opportunities are there to export products made in South Africa to Iran. I met with American businesses during a visit to the West Africa session in Rwanda, where they laid out their stall of countries that they are looking to invest in. Secondly, besides meetings with investors, we also did some site visits. And in particular in this quarter, we did the launch of the new Toyota Fortuner and Hilux Bucky in eThekwini. South Africa has been chosen again by Toyota to be the site for the production of Hilux for export markets and the Toyota Fortuner for South Africa and the African continent. Third, we had social dialogue sessions with business and labor, which I've reported on. Fourthly, we held two Imbizo sessions with fashion retailers, manufacturers and the union on the future of the industry and on export potential for industry. And finally, the department did some work on unblocking obstacles to getting investment flowing. The first example is South 32, and it produces manganese in Mayetan, and its plant was scheduled to close down as lost export orders due to the depressed steel market. We introduced South 32 to ArcelorMittal because we were talking to both companies about their respective problems, and the effect of this is that we were able to contribute to saving 283 jobs and export beneficiated manganese to the United States. The second one is Colibri Towels. It's a plant is stranded in the Western Cape, and we connected them with a Massmart Supply Development Program. They received 2.7 million rand grant funding. They bought 30 industrial machines and they created 80 additional jobs. And the plan is to become a strategic supplier to Massmart stores. The third one is Broadway Footwear. It's a black-owned suite manufacturer with 480 workers in Gauteng. What's interesting about them is they sell mainly through a network of 18,000 walkers. We turn sell in spider shops, taxi racks, and so on. And they had quite a number of challenges. We did a bit of work with them to unlock access to the competitiveness enhancement funding and to address their challenge with illegal imports and access to raw material supplies. And we did a site visit. Next area was we had a request from the petroleum industry for designation in terms of the Competition Act, and we agreed to a short period in order to give stability to the sector, and this is still the basis of thinking and work in the ministry. Moving to KPI 17, which is industrial funding, it's kind of connected a little bit to investment. The IDC released its annual financial results recently, and I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to go into it, but just to lift out some of the big numbers, total disbursements of 11.4 billion rand, funding approvals for the year 14.5 billion rand, which is quite a significant rise on the previous year, 26% rise. Black empowered companies have received support to the tune of 4.9 billion rand. Youth empowered enterprises, I've already covered that. Women empowered enterprises, 1.2 billion rand, which is almost 60% higher. And jobs supported through IDC funding, about 15,000. So that's for the year as a whole, because the results are now available. For the quarter, approvals in the quarter were 772 million, relatively significant disbursement also, and women empowered approvals, 158 million. I make a point, though, that when I go through the data of the quarterly report by the IDC, we're going to need to ramp up the rate of new job creation. And this is going to be the big challenge, because we're getting the money flowing, but we've got to lift the employment level up as the money goes through the system. Here you see some of that detail set out over the period, and you can see the Black Industries Program is new, and it's gone from zero 3 years ago to 2.8 billion rand, and the other data are all set out in there. This breaks down IDC funding net approvals by sector, so we can see where the money goes, and you can see basic and specialty chemicals and basic metals and mining are quite significant contributors, as is industrial infrastructure. On the strategic engagements, a number of meetings, 5 meetings for the IDC in the quarter. Big bit of work is on the human resource framework and the remuneration philosophy, and the turnaround data for the IDC for the quarter, 43 days on average between application and decision. turning to the link between infrastructure and productive investment, we managed in this quarter to get the final approval of the $180 million loan approved by the BRICS New Development Bank. That brings us then to the competition issue, which has been subject of quite a bit of comment, including in Parliament and in the media. And so in this period, there were four big competition issues. I would say that probably this has been the most significant competition quarter for the last couple of years. The first was the wrap-up around the Neotel-Vodacom transaction. The second one was the substantial resolution of the Coca-Cola transaction. The third was the substantial completion of the SAB Miller AB InBev merger, and the fourth one was the promulgation of the criminalization provisions of the Competition Amendment Act. So turning to Vodacom Neotel, during 2015, Vodacom, which is the largest cell phone company, said that they wanted to buy Neotel. Neotel has got two big assets. They've got some fixed lines, which competes with Telkom, but they have something really important called Spectrum. And Spectrum is the gold standard in the digital economy. And they applied to the Competition Commission. The Commission says, fine, we approve this, but for 2 years, you can't use the Spectrum for Vodacom. After that, you can use it. We looked at this, and we commissioned some work on the economics of it, and we came to the conclusion that if the largest company gets this additional spectrum, it will have an advantage over all of its competitors. None of them would have the spectrum. And it would be such quality spectrum, meaning it would give such expanded access to Vodacom that you'd consolidate Vodacom as the effectively long-term it will become the monopoly supplier. And we were worried about that because you need a competitive market. You need people to be trampling on each other's toes and bringing down prices. We then did quite a bit of work on the law. What right does the competition authorities have to intervene in this? Is it an ICASA matter or is the competition matter too? Because you have two regulators. And the matter went very quickly through ICASA. Incidentally, afterwards, the High Court overturned that decision. And so we did quite a bit of work there. Thirdly, we met with the company and we met with competitors and we said, how will this affect you? And finally, we made a submission to the Competition Tribunal together with a detailed economic analysis done by an expert, and we drew on international experience where relevant. And essentially, we said, looking at this transaction, we think it's a bad transaction. Do one of two things. Either prohibit it and leave the parties to compete, or alternatively, if you approve it, provide that the spectrum must be used equally by all the competitors. So Vodacom can own it, but it must be fair use policies where any other competitor can have access to that spectrum for a price. And the price has to be fair recovery. So in other words, Vodacom doesn't build a monopoly. Other people then, when they saw where we were heading, the MTN objected, Cell C, Telkom, and I mentioned Data, or otherwise known as Internet Solutions, also objected. They each pointed out how this would completely distort the market. At the end of the day, after a bit of an engagement at the tribunal, Vodacom and Neotel were asked to redo their thinking completely. The minute they were put in the witness box, asked some questions, it became evident that what they had proposed has much deeper implications than the Competition Commission had originally been aware of. Later, Vodacom announced and Neotel announced that they're discontinuing the merger. They're abandoning it, and we close this transaction in the quarter. Now, the significance of this is that we provided the public authorities, the competition authorities in this case, with an independent assessment of the proposed merger. It's not what Telkom's view is or MTN's view. Neither is it what Vodacom's view is. We could come into it looking at it more objectively. We worked very closely with the Minister of Posts and Telecommunications, And the fact that the proposed transaction was withdrawn maintains the current levels of competition, and it avoids a further concentration of market dominance in mobile telephony. So when we talk about the issue of we've got to combat monopolies, it's not just tackling existing monopolies, it's avoiding new monopolies from growing and developing. Moving then to Coca-Cola. I think the broad storyline is well known in the committee, so I'm going to just recap quite quickly. Coca-Cola currently bottles all of the sweet black liquid through four bottlers in South Africa. And they want the three of the bottlers to merge under the leadership of S.A.G. Miller. And part of the deal was Apple ties the brand would effectively be transferred to Coca-Cola. We looked at it, and we saw that this is a very significant transaction in size and on impact. And we did quite a bit of work on it, analyzing the merger, looking at the employment impact, the impact on small bottlers, because there's quite a few smaller bottlers that are nipping Coca-Cola at the ankles. If you go into the supermarket, you now see a much greater variety of these sweet, sugary juices and liquids. And we were also concerned about what it means to shift Appetizer from S.A.B. Miller to Coca-Cola. And of course, S.A.B. Miller wasn't really a fully South African company, headquartered in London, but it was much more of an emotion link. So these are all the issues that we needed to. What's the impact of shifting our only real interesting soft drink beverage to a global player? Would it mean production also moves offshore? So we engaged the company, and it was quite a process. And I wish I was completely at liberty to just speak frankly. Obviously, some of the discussions were covered by confidentiality issues, but they were quite interesting. At the end, we settled on some matters, and it became evident we were miles apart on other issues. It was the fundamental two issues, lots of little issues, but two fundamental issues were jobs. Because we had reason to believe, let me use that phrase, we had reason to believe that there would be very substantial job losses if the transaction went through as was contemplated. Because three bottlers would be consolidated, and we need the numbers ourselves. And we had access to numbers that got through a discovery process. And secondly, we were very concerned that creating this massive bottler, together with Coca-Cola as a dominant brand, could effectively close the market for new competitors to come in. And so we focus on this. Because we couldn't resolve this issue, the scene was set for a fight at the tribunal, and I think everybody expected government would blink. We didn't blink, and in the end, we had a meeting with the president of Coca-Cola International, the CEO of Sav Miller, and the head of the Kutchi family, and in that discussion, we identified basically a package that would get to the point where government would not oppose the merger. And I'll take the committee briefly through that package because it's been in the public domain. But the significance of it is the conditions attached to this merger helps me evolve our competition policy. There was an important competition appeal court judgment by the judge president in the Walmart matter that clarified the public interest issues. And is public interest a nice to have, or is it a fundamental element competition authorities must look at? And the courts clarified it's a fundamental issue. And so using that judgment, we've now begun to ensure that there is a consistent application of the public interest that is set out in the Act to competition considerations. We secured significant outcomes on employment, small business development, empowerment, opening the market to smaller players, and the promotion of smallholder farming. So what was the essential agreement? There were many, I'm just going to cover, I think, seven of them. The first is on employment. We agreed with the parties, and eventually it was made a part of the settlement, that Coca-Cola will maintain current total employment levels in South Africa for a three-year period. So irrespective of what happens in the market, the total employment would remain constant. So if people retire, they'll replace people. If they fire people, they'll replace people. And they also agreed that no worker would either bargaining unit or be retrenched as a result of the merger. In any company, typically what happens is the bargaining units are, call them unionized workers, although it's not an accurate description. It's basically people except your more senior managers and some white collar, highly paid categories. So in that bargaining unit, which accounts for the bulk of staff in the Coca-Cola company, they've agreed even in future, no worker will be a retrenched as a result of the merger. Outside the bargaining unit, they will limit retrenchments to a maximum of 250 senior staff. Second, on employment in the supply chain, they made 800 million rand available to promote employment outside their bottling plants. 400 million to bring smaller farmers and small packaging companies into the market and into their supply chains. And 400 million to support opening of new spaza shops and retail outlets. Third one is perhaps one of the most significant elements of it. And that is, if you go into a spaza shop, it's a small little place. There's one fridge normally, or display unit with glass and so on. And there's a sign outside, a big sign in red and white, and it's not a political party sign. When you go into that store, there's typically one kind of beverage. Different brands of it, but all the one kind. And the reason is because that fridge is normally bought by, in this case, Coca-Cola. And typically, they would only allow their own beverages in there. Now, the spaza shop owner don't have the money to buy a second fridge, but even if someone else was prepared to put up the money, there isn't space. Because it's a small little place. So that's given big players a natural monopoly. Not because their prices are better, not because their products are better, but because they control the fridge. And we've tried through competition measures. The commission has been involved in a long-standing fight with SAB Miller, because the same thing happens with beer. And it's lost those fights through the legal processes. So in this case, we reached an agreement that 10% of the fridge space in smaller spaza shops and retail outlets will be available to rival brands of the smaller bottlers. And we've only taken out the top three bottlers in the world. So even a medium-sized bottler that bottles a beverage can have access to that fridge space. The work that's been done so far by Coca-Cola suggests that it could be as much as 117 stores and retail outlets where a competitor's product can be put in. Now, that's quite a significant potential opening of the market. The fourth one is Appetizer, which is a South African brand by origin. South Africa will remain the key production center for Appetizer products sold here and in the rest of Africa. And Black South Africans will have 20% of equity in the Appetizer company. And sourcing of inputs will continue from South African suppliers. So basically, we're maintaining some kind of link with the Appetizer brand. The third one is localization of inputs. Within Coca-Cola group as a whole, localization of sourcing will be prioritized. They can have supplier conferences annually. They can have local procurement reports available to show how the Coca-Cola company is helping to not just provide sugary drinks to South Africans, but also creating jobs in South Africa. And that will, of course, assist to industrialize South Africa. On empowerment, the South African operations will have a 20% BEE equity. That's now Coca-Cola, the bottling plant, which is an increase from what they proposed originally of 11%. And then the headquarters, this will be Africa's largest bottling plant, by the way, for soft drinks. And it will retain its headquarters in South Africa. And that was quite important for us, because a lot of jobs and value addition is generated by where your headquarters are. In the red box, we say the total public interest value of the transaction is not just the 800 million rand, it's all these other elements. But even if we just take the 800 million alone, that is worth more than 5 years of the EDD budget, if you take out the money that's transferred to the entities. So Parliament is obviously seeking constantly to find examples of value for money on the funds that Parliament votes, because we at the mercy ultimately of Parliament who votes these funds. So here you've voted about 150 million rand as EDD's core budget, and just one transaction we're able to ensure a development impact of significantly more than that. And I think that's to the credit really of Parliament. The AB InBev acquisition of Sam Miller. AB InBev is the world's largest beer brewer. They're based in Belgium, and SAB Miller is the second largest in the world, and they're based in London. During 2015, AB InBev said they want to buy SAB Miller, and this would make it one of the largest global mergers ever in any industry, and by a long shot, the largest merger in South African corporate history. We engaged the company on the merger, and we had quite a significant outcome. I was great to the outcome. Protection of employment, 5 years, for 5 years they'll maintain the current jobs. It's roughly 6,000 at the aggregate level. So if people leave, they'll replace them. And honourable members that have seen, there was an announcement by AB InBev, or it was a newspaper story that they intend in the next 3 years to cut jobs globally as a result of the merger. South Africa's got that protection. So we now need to build the relations so that at the end of that period, we're still a big employer of labour. No worker within the bargaining unit will be retrenched as a result of the merger. 1 billion rand additional money will be spent to support employment. They're going to bring 800 new smallholder farmers into the supply chain, and they've also set aside funding to support entrepreneurship and social programs. 10% of the fridge space in taverns will be open to craft brewers, and they've had to divest from their shareholding in Distell. On the localization of inputs, the company will focus on producing hops and barley locally. And in fact, at the moment, we import some of the components that are going to brew making, into beer making. And they've committed to work with us to turn South Africa into a net exporter of malt, which is the value addition product that's used. Empowerment, they've got an empowerment scheme they've inherited from Sam Miller. They'll continue with it till expiry. And then a few years before expiry, they'll table their new proposals to us. And the African headquarters of the new company will be in South Africa. And some of the significance is set out below in the box. We've set quite significant and useful public interest guidelines, and there's been a modest but first opening of the beer retail market with the facility for craft brewers, and the 1 billion rand fund alone is worth 7 years of EDD budget. There was also a story in the newspapers about a U.S. lawyer urging the U.S. authorities to consider this African approach. Moving to page 57, this is the criminalization of cartel and collusive conduct that was promulgated and was announced, of course, in the budget vote. And these are the dates when different aspects of the law was promulgated. And what this is quite a significant stepping up of our action to make sure that we move beyond simply imposing fines. That people must know that they can go to jail for 10 years if they collude. So that it's really a signal in the market. In KPI 22, we've also issued a policy directive to ITAC on what to consider when evaluating applications for customs duties. We've brought jobs, industrialization to the center there. On the trade side, we've provided some information on trade developments over the last 10 years. What it shows is that trade with the rest of the world has tripled in dollar terms, but there have been changes also. We used to be exporting quite a lot to the European Union. We're now exporting proportionally much more to the rest of Africa and to BRICS, and exports to the U.S. have remained flat over this period. In value terms, the U.S. exports are still significant, and quite importantly, it's value-added exports, manufactured goods. The key issue in trade always is the aggregate impact. You lose more, you gain more from your trading regime. And we've done some work. I wasn't comfortable to put it on yet because obviously the proceedings of the committee is public. But we've done a bit of work trying to see what is the employment, the net employment impact of our trading relationships. Are we losing more jobs or gaining more jobs in our relations with China, the European Union, the United States, and so on? And more work is required on the methodology before we're confident we can defend the results in the public domain. So hopefully in future we can bring that in. Growth in exports to the rest of Africa and BRICS has been relatively strong. And our top export products is iron ore, cars and trucks, platinum, coal, and refined fuels. Our top imports is crude oil, refined fuel, cars and trucks, phones, and computers. Now, the anomaly or interesting thing is fuel. We import crude fuel, we refine it, and we sell it to neighboring countries. So it's even higher on the import side than it would ordinarily be. It's also significant on the export side. Where do we sell to? Where do we buy from? We sell to China, United States, Germany, Namibia, and Botswana in that order. Very interesting. Namibia and Botswana make it in the top five for South Africa. And where do we buy from? We buy from China, Germany, United States, India, and Japan. We've also put in two slides just of little interesting factoids or bits of information on trade that honorable members want to look at. I'm not going to go through all of it, but Namibia is our biggest export destination in the continent, and our main export in Namibia is like trucks, for example. We export to the rest of the continent fuel. Nigeria is the main supplier of crude oil for the first time. It used to be Saudi Arabia. 18% of our imports in 2015 were from China, and some of the significant products we buy from China are cell phones and computers, laptops, iPads, those things. Our trade deficit with the European Union is $10 billion. That's very, very significant. So Europe offered us, early in the start of our democracy, a development agreement that would benefit South Africa and support our democracy. It's proving to be quite helpful to the European economy, I must say. India is the largest source of South African medicine imports. Where do we sell our platinum to? To Japan, United States, and the UK. Where do we sell our coal? Do we sell it to India? And where do we sell our iron ore to? We sell it to China. We did some work with ITAC. We were a bit concerned about ITAC's budget spending in this quarter, so the department did a bit of work, and some of the engagements with ITAC has been on their budget for the first quarter, and the results set out in slide 65. We did some work with the Competition Commission on their annual reports, on their analyzing their operation financial report. We got some feedback from the AG and so on. And then finally, before we deal with the information on the finances, we've also got the human resource movement. We know that the Portfolio Committee, in the report on the previous budget, asked us to report more specifically on HR and recruitment. The DGs put together some information on the finalization of the organogram, where we are, meetings with DPSA, project land submitted, meetings held with organized labor and DSA to get concurrence. On the vacancies, we've got 140 funded posts on the establishment. 117 were filled by the end of March. In addition to that, we had two people that were employed, but they were in addition to the establishment. In other words, skills we needed didn't quite fit in the old organogram. And then so that brings about 119. They contracted two WITS University staff through MOU to do work for us, and we had access to 10 PICC technical unit people who are located at the IDC who do work for us on infrastructure. If you take all of that together, 131. If you take all of the staff as a whole that we have direct control over through these systems, then our vacancy rate would be equivalent to 6%. If you take WIT and the PICC specialists out, then our vacancy rate would be 15%. I have asked that the university staff be placed on EDD's staffing, that we begin to take the best thinkers in the country and bring them into the department, not just as full-time, as part-time staff members. On the recruitment, DG provides some information to us on slide 71. A specialist in executive search was contracted to assist us with the following three posts. On the CFO, this was actually quite interesting when this was given to me, because it shows just the challenges. We had an advert on the 29th of April, closure 6th of May, panel 1st of June, shortlist 3rd June, interviews 8 July, clearance, security clearance 13 July, assessments. Now, once you've done all of it, you send them to an independent assessment where psychologists go through and takes them through quite a rigorous process with them too. We did the assessments on the 21st of July. By the 2nd of August, the department concluded, based on the assessment, that no one was appointable because of the report that was given, and it's now re-advertising. So it's just a frustrating process to get this kind of thing done, but I thought it very useful when the DG shared this with me that we put it in the report. There's also information on the acting heads, the stability in the department, branch meetings, governance, and so on. And then the final section is the EDD financials, which the DG could just share with your commission, take us through before I make a concluding comment.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Minister. On the financials, the summary is on page 74. As of 30th...
I thought perhaps you will... the reason I was looking at this... or maybe let's leave that question aside. Yeah, we'll deal with that question.
Thank you, Chairperson. As of 30th of June, department spent 163.8 million out of an allocation of 674.7 million, i.e. 24% of the allocated budget. As of 30th of June, expenditure excluding transfer amounts to 29.9 million out of 1.459, i.e. 21% of baseline allocation. For the quarter, the department spent 163.8 million made up of 133.9 transfers to entities and 29.9 million spent directly by the department. Total expenditure is 96% of the quarterly allocation of 170.4 million. And on the other pages, we have the various tables that detail the budget program as well as the economic classification. And if I may take you to page 79, deals with the variances on this. We've got compensation of employees, processes in place to fill vacant critical posts in line with the strategic plan and annual performance plan. Goods and services, delays of billing from the DGI, the office accommodation, the office of state attorney, outstanding legal costs. This relates to the mergers and the public interest mergers that Minister has spoken about. Transfers and subsidy spending is in line with plan spending and capital assets. Various relates to part payment, internal audit, page software. I think that's fairly self-explanatory. Thanks for your time, Chairperson.
Chairperson, it's really just my responsibility to say that concludes the presentation, and it covers, of course, 6 month period. And it's taken a bit of time, I'm sorry, that's taken quite a bit of time, and I really appreciate the time, Chairperson, you've given, because you also wanted to go beyond just a quick tick box into some of the substance issues that the department deals with. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister, and SDG. I guess that is quite necessary, because sometimes we are asked a very... There are questions that we normally do not interact with in this committee because of time constraints, maybe. But the fact that we're able to go through those issues and even those that we didn't think that we would bring to our attention is much appreciated. I think we have done a great thing. I think what we need to do, I don't think we must spend much time on the fourth quarter report. I'll tell you why, because we're going to be really engaging with the department on the annual report, and that is covered under the annual report, the fourth quarter report. This was just for us to be able to have all the quarters so that we can be able to compare with the annual report. Most of our focus should go towards the first quarter of the financial year. I must just commend the department really for the improvement in the reporting. There's great improvement, and you can follow things quite easily, and that needs to be commended really. We are going to start with the non-financial report, aspects of the report, and then we'll then go back to the human resource and finance. We're going to combine the human resource and finance. May I be interested in the Atkinson? Is it then? Please show. Raise your hands to show interest in the discussion. Dr. Kado, any other? Lema Tindi? Babu Kreli? In that order, please.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you so much, and in particular for your section on the fourth industrial revolution. I think it's always interesting to hear, obviously, information that you get when you go to conferences like the World Economic Forum and various other places that you provide us with some of that insight that they are getting in your PV sessions there. With regard to the fourth industrial revolution, I'd just like to relate back to the presentation that we had last week by the OECD, where they highlighted the two major problems in the South African economy was our very, very high rate of youth unemployment. Another was about issues of labor relations. So I think just looking at the youth unemployment particularly, obviously people that are going to be most heavily affected by the fourth industrial revolution will be young people, basically, and people that are suffering from youth unemployment at the moment. And I think probably the fundamental underlying factor there is the issue of training, the issue of education, of how people are going to be able to take advantage of the big economic changes we've seen going forward. So my question to you is, will you be engaging with ministers in the educational ministries, basic education, higher education, training, just to discuss the necessities and as to how they might look at institutionalism and policy in future? And I also think it would be quite helpful in future if you could include some item on the fourth industrial revolution future reports just to see what you're kind of doing, because obviously this is something we need to that we need to deal with as our if our country's economy is going to be able to prosper and to survive. The second question was with relation to the trade deals that we were just talking about the various different trading relations we've got. And I was just wondering, in light of since we last met, there has been Brexit, Britain looking to leave the European Union, whether we are beginning to look at the opportunities that would avail themselves to a direct trade relationship with the UK, and whether we are starting to move down that road at the moment. And then just the final point was, I went to a presentation by the Postmaster General, our new Postmaster General, for a while ago, and he made a really, very interesting point. So I'd like to link this back into your the funding of the IDC puts forward for youth, which was the same person on a billion rand. And he pointed out that most post banks around the world have actually got, as in fact, they've got very large amounts of clients. I think China, the Chinese post bank has nearly 400 million clients. But the issue at the moment is we can only take deposits. We actually can't borrow. And he was talking about the effects of if the post office could get involved in the small loan or what we call the cash loan market, it could have a major economic effect on people who run small businesses who try and seek financing. But at the moment they have to go to a lot of the private institutions. And because of the cost of funding for private institutions, most of these cash loans have prohibitive interest rates and fees as well that actually make it extremely difficult for people to be able to properly run a small business if they're paying the kind of interest rates that they are. And he was just saying that through the post bank, your cost of funding is effectively the country bond rate. So we could actually run a situation to be able to provide the small loans to businesses and entrepreneurs at interest rates far below what one is getting at the moment from private industry. And we were talking about the velocity of money, particularly at that level of the market where, you know, with smaller entrepreneurs, that they would actually be able to borrow that money and would be able to, it would help them to basically buy more goods and fund their small businesses. So the question I'm putting here is, are you potentially going to be discussing with the post office the possibility of it being another source of funding that might actually be dealing with people that would not necessarily be covered by the IDC? And I'm talking particularly about small business now, where people can go and get loans and actually help to create better velocity in that market of business, basically. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, Minister, for a wonderful presentation. Let me quickly, you know, indicate my appreciation for the three appointments that we made, the senior staff there, those 18 heads. We appreciate the fact that, you know, you were able to make the appointment, Minister. It will take us a long way in improving the work of the department. Also, we'd like to appreciate the work that is being done by the department around the issue of measures. We are protecting a lot of works for the public good there. We are taking care of the public there. We appreciate the initiative of the department in that regard. The first question, Minister, is around the 90,000 jobs that were lost in the Western Cape. It's a massive number. We appreciate it, and the Minister could just remind us as to which industries are involved in this regard. Also, maybe get an indication as to what the provincial government is doing in trying to salvage the situation there. The second question is around the conference that was held in Rwanda, the World Economic Forum Africa Chapter. We want to have this question, Minister, as you know that the economies, the countries in China, they are intertwined, in fact, on the continent, but primarily in the Arctic region. There are problems presently in Zimbabwe and elsewhere, which are obviously impacting on the economy of South Africa. What ideas were discussed in that World Economic Forum? Because I think heads of states were present there. Just an idea as to whether there's some kind of a plan that was discussed to focus on the SADC region. The last question, Minister, relates to the measures. We're aware now that there's been several measures that have been authorized to proceed, and there are numerous commitments that were made by these companies as regards to, you know, ensuring that there are no retrenchments and so on, and other commitments that were made by these companies when their measures were authorized. The question is, how sharp is our monitoring tool to ensure that we follow up on the commitments to make sure that the companies live up to the commitments that they've made? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Senator Christian.
Thanks, Minister.
Thanks, Minister, for a very comprehensive presentation. I had a few specific questions. The first one is whether you could just provide us with some more detail on the commitment by the government of Flanders to provide 6.5 million rand for the development of a social economy project. Just be curious to know exactly what that project entails and what the timelines are. Secondly, I was hoping you could update us on the price preferencing system amendments that were gazetted in December last year and the consultation that took place between ITAC and
as oral hearings, I think they were. And then finally, on the question of public interest guidelines for mergers, my understanding is that those public interest guidelines were finalized in June of this year. And in those finalized guidelines is a new sort of catch-all tone guiding merging parties to consider the impact on a sector that involves influences constitutionally entrenched rights. I was wondering whether you could speak to what exactly that means, the constitutionally entrenched rights. How broad is the ambit of that provision, and exactly what does it entail? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me also welcome the two presentations by the minister. They were very much informative and clearly guiding us. I've got only two questions. I've heard you saying that you must not focus on quarter four, but I've got just one interest on the DSAM training. I just want to know what impact has it had to us, the DSAM training, to our economy. I've just seen that the training was not part of the plan, but as they focus to intensify the jobs, they've decided to put the training. I wanted to know how so far what impact has the training has on us. And on quarter one, the high level of unemployed youth, it's very alarming and frustrating, as we know that the young people are our agent of change, but seeing them so unemployed is frustrating. I really appreciate the intervention by IDC on youth entrepreneur, but their pace is very slow. I just want to know from the department side, what other plans are in place to see that the young entrepreneurs are in numbers, because the numbers are 900. We are really moving, but the move is so slow. What are other plans in ensuring that we empower more entrepreneurs? Thank you.
Yes, Chairperson. We welcome the presentation by the Minister. Mine is related to the last question that was asked by Honourable Siana. I would like to add on that question, the use of the spanner shops and the retail outlets, how many are they going to benefit out of this 100 million? And who determines which one gets in?
Thanks. Just to piggyback also on the issue of entrepreneurship, youth entrepreneurship. I just want to appreciate this type of intervention, what opportunities, the entrepreneurial opportunities to improve the access of the youth. I want to find out is qualitative nature of this opportunity. That could be after ownership. After taking ownership by them. I'm asking this because normally you find that there are these opportunities taken, but then the challenge is going forward, the sustainability becomes very weak. And then we have to come back again and, you know, sell back more money into the same company. Are we as a country really preparing our entrepreneurs well to take over the types of companies that they're seeking? Are we satisfied as this department in terms of the quality of entrepreneurs, especially the young entrepreneurs that we have, whether they will be able to sustain the companies they're owning into the future? The minister just taken us through the fourth industrial revolution. looking at the picture now, are you comfortable that they will be able to take us through that, or even be able to navigate through the challenges that we might be faced through the introduction of the fourth revolution? It's a bit scary the way you painted the picture, scarier in terms of really going to sustain the economy in the hands of a few, because it's those few that are able to navigate easily. And you spoke to issues that might also hamper or perhaps prevent us from entering this revolution in the much, you know, speed way as we would want to. And some of those have to do with the research and development, which I think is the song that has been singing for the, I don't know, for quite a long time. I'm not saying as a country not doing much, but I think we really need to ensure that maybe we take out this from the institutions, because that's where we're focusing and we really spend more money on. But rather to create a dedicated, even if it's a useful kind of an institution or platform, where we'll be able. I was impressed last time when we visited the SAD in Pretoria. SAD Design Institute in Pretoria. I was quite impressed because it showed us the capacity or capability we have in South Africa. But my problem is that we're not actually putting, we probably are not reading this for the first time, but we're not putting much effort and focus on improving on the readily available or what we have in place, but rather are looking elsewhere, and we're not even sure whether where we're looking is really where we ought to be looking at. I hope I'm making sense on this issue that I'm trying to raise. The many of our youth are feeling a bit discouraged, mainly because of the way our teachers are really treating them, or officials who are supposed to be service providers are treating them. Some, of course, might not be having that type of skill that is needed in terms of being a true entrepreneur. I think this follows a question that I asked before, earlier on. But I thought that through a bit of patience and a show of compassion, we'd be able to build on and, you know, retain the self-esteem of this young person who's really having everything, you know, in terms of the willingness and the vigor that that person is willing to put into that business, but lacking the actual, you know, skills that are necessary in order to develop that entrepreneurship inside that person. I'm asking again the question because I'm worried about the long-term sustainability of some of this. If you come from mid-1990s to now, you realize that we've invested a lot of money on new entrepreneurs. But when you look at the outcome or the output, let me put it that way, it's not as one would want it to be. There's no value for money if you were to compare. I'll be very much interested in getting that type of research done, checking as to how much have we invested in new, especially towards our youth, new businesses owned by the youth since, let's say, 1997, if I were to go back to date. And how many of those businesses are hinging on their own and are successful, are said to be successful, and how many of those are those that have not succeeded, and what lessons have we learned from that? And in our approach now, how are we really improving our systems so that we are able to create better businesses for the young ones? I had thought that the previous cooler had done something to that regard, but hence we introduced the thing with the new the direct lending issue, which was going to make things easier, and SIDA was going to play their role and so forth. Now, having been combined into SIFA, I thought that was going to create quite a quick kind of response from government, or especially the youth. And then we were going to be able now to talk qualitative results. I'm not too sure where I'm standing in terms of my personal view on that, but from what I hear outside, I'm really not convinced that that measure is really producing the fruits that we had intended. Mainly because of the type of people that is employed in the offices dealing with that. They themselves are not that well equipped to deal with people, especially the young people. I think these are some of the things that we really need to look into for us to make a real impact in the life of the youth. I've said a lot of things around this, and I know the minister will be, and the deputy minister, maybe in the DG will be able to respond to that. The other question that I have is our investment in other countries, especially African countries, the minister, obviously done by the IGC. I just want to know how risk averse are those investments. You know, are we, especially those countries that are not stable? I know that some parties and countries are always complaining about us not being politically stable. But there are war-torn countries where we are investing. One would want to find out whether we're comfortable with our investments, and if anything should happen, what will happen to our investments in those countries. It's a very politically questionable question, but I have to ask it anyway. I also want to ask Minister, in terms of the new amendments to the ISA Act and the Competition Act, whether they are still in the pipeline and when are they coming. As Parliament expected to register any introduction of any new laws or amendments on time, so that we can be able to be given an opportunity to focus on that. So it's important that we as Portfolio Committee are also able to look into that. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, to you and to the honourable members for that set of questions and observations. I wonder if I could ask the Deputy Minister to have an opportunity first just to respond to some of the issues, and now deal with the remainder of the issues. Thank you.
First, I just want to speak to the issue around the youth and of a major on the possibility of looking at the kind of investment that has been done up to now in these 20 years so that we can learn lessons from. Because currently we are engaged in a study around CO2 incentives and see since we have accepted it, what is it that will then happen. So I think also I think we'll consider just looking at the legislation like giving to check if there's anyone that might have done it. And also, if it's not there, maybe looking at ourselves doing that. But on the matter on whether the kind of initiatives that we have, or whether the kind of initiative that we have for youth is sustainable, and also whether we have got them. We have are there preparing the youth to do that. I want to say that part of the things that you have just pointed out there to interact with the youth in the industry about that. It's just about saying yes, you've got policy, because we can't say go and regurgitate them. We don't talk to them when you go there. We don't go and regurgitate and say this is what we do. We listen to them and say, where are you? What are you doing? What are the issues? What are you critical challenges that we are facing. One of the examples that I want to show is that when we had that in the discussion, we had ESCOM, we had IDC in there with all other NEF. As they do speak and they point out their frustration on where they start, it was easy that ESCOM will come in and say, oh, we see that we've got a problem on supplier, we've got a problem on supplier development. All of you that are in that area, can we go and test and give you an opportunity to do it? So we actually realize that the frustrations are right at the corner because you end up not having the interaction with the actual industry. We also have CIDA in this forum, CIDA and FIFA in the same discussions, and we are able to see where are the specific challenges that young people, and then start working on them to look at interventions to get them to move forward. The presidential working group also, we participate there and we identify the frustration, what they call dialogues, youth dialogues. We have got dialogues with the youth, the industry, that industry, and so on. And as we engage on that, we identify these blockages and we are able to like go assist and see and how we can assist them. The last dialogue that we had was with the young people in the art industry. The kind of things that they were having as a challenge, which range from their development of the script, access to funding, and so on, and access to market. And we had in that from IDC, we had NFVF, we had SABC, and in other ones, we also had the industry, like your new metro, and so on, and they were actually designing exactly what is the kind of quality that we have. So we are able then to see this is where the gap is. For instance, in this interaction, we could be able to see that the quality that is required by State Metro and New Metro and what is being discussed by the entrepreneur, they might have a challenge in relation to that. Then we say, NABF, can you come in here to assist them in terms of that development? And also for SABC to give platform for some of them to start exercising here. So it's that kind of work that we are like engaged in the special youth group. The on the research and development as the chair you raised, there is a discussion there in terms of how within government on the how we should look at budgeting and reprioritizing of our focus. I think very soon there might be sooner be an announcement on the details of that. But I want just to indicate that it's beginning to be an appreciation that part of the priorities that must be on top is your higher education, so research and development that is going to lead into that. And it is coming out of all those experiences that we have in the SABS programs, your research and development that we're in SRC and all the other institutions, and also in the innovative hub, coming out also the inputs and the frustrations that are coming out of the young people that are actually involved there. Those that have actually gone through design problems, design programs of new products, but they can't lift them into the market. Like the minister was saying, if you have a product, you can't massify it, you can't get it to the market, it's as good as not having it. So those are the aspects that will probably be dominating our work so soon.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you to the Deputy Minister for those additional remarks. Just let me query the other questions that were asked. If I could just go through the order that were asked on Honourable Atkinson's suggestion of a regular discussion on the fourth industrial revolution. I think it's an excellent idea. Even if it's once a year or twice a year, in our quarterly reports, we provide a few slides showing what's happening in the country, what in fact we're doing. In fact, I think it would also spur us to think more actively about whether we're getting the industrial development benefits from R&D spending. So I would really like to take that up. On the trade deals with Brexit, in the light of Brexit with the UK, I think at this stage everybody is watching the UK. They've got to clear the formal 2-year exit period talks. And obviously, once they've done that, then the issue will become live for us. Should the UK exit the European Union, which is what the plan with exit is, clearly there will have to be an engagement with all of their trading partners, and they will have to enter into many, many agreements all over the world. So at this stage, I think we're all just waiting. A trigger is the key. On the post-bank, it's a very interesting and quite detailed discussion that is sparked by Honourable Atkinson's remarks. I think it may need a bit more time for us to do proper justice to the discussion. Today, our thinking has been that if we can get the post office infrastructure available to the post-bank, one of the opportunities it creates is that we don't need to duplicate the CIFA infrastructure all over the country. We have a ready-made window to communities. And so before CIFA was transferred to Small Business Development for a broad strategic direction, we had put, I'm sure my colleague would want to continue this, that we create a window in each post bank. Sometimes a real window, sometimes a virtual window, because you could do it with Skype, where you could have a screen set up in a rural area with a post office there for a post bank. You could teach a post office staff how to switch the thing on. You could sit a young person or even an older person who needs access to capital, and they could link up to the provincial headquarters of CIFA or even the national one. And you can take people through step by step what's required in a more user-friendly way than through written documentation, which in many cases are an effective barrier for people to get into. Now, of course, as we build that up, in larger locations, the post bank itself needs to have the expertise to evaluate. It could be done without DFIs, because the big challenge is not getting money to people, it's working throughout to avoid allocations of money that are over risky. Risk is inherent when you're trying to break into new markets. If you go too far, you'll just exhaust your money. And the post office staff is obviously not set up. So the post bank, and I think CEO is a very interesting person, and he's going to no doubt be doing a lot of things. How does it build up a technical capability to be able to manage some of the banking
concessions. As that falls up, I think it opens up many interesting possibilities. The challenge with deposits always, unlike equity, is that you absolutely have to guarantee that you have the money if depositors come back for the money. And so you normally have a much more risk-averse profile when you deal with deposits than if you deal with equity. So I have no doubt that this will require a little bit of conversation with the Postbank to see how we use that marvelous potential infrastructure to bring development finance to local communities. I think it's a useful thing, but there are challenges, and probably we should be having a discussion with Mr. Barnes to just flesh that out a bit. On Bukyan is the first question was on the 9,000 jobs in Western Cape. Now, someone is saying about us. We all go through it at some stage in life. The Western Cape job losses, look, it was very, very substantial. So when we look at it, the key driver of it was agriculture. And according to the official statistics, just over 40,000 jobs lost in agriculture in one quarter. Now, the other big driver was trade, which you'd expect to happen because typically, as I said, after the Christmas period, people are taken on during the Christmas period, there are discharged. It's normally a short-term contract, and the contract normally comes to end after Christmas. So you do expect a little bit of a dip. And then quite a lot of job losses were also in government, 26,000, and in private business services. Now, I'm going to be cautious how I put this, because it wouldn't like a wrong headline about it. But with all surveys, the more you narrow down the survey, the less robust results become. And that's why I'm often amused at the point scoring that happens in the society from all sides when results come out. Because when you take the big picture, you're looking for a thin line rather than fixation with one quarter, because you're never sure whether the figures are so robust enough for a quarter, to put it in different language. Because the sample could be smaller at sub-national level. The sample could be influenced by all things. You see, does the job numbers, is it mirrored in the GDP numbers? Do the job numbers show the same trend in a couple of quarters in a row? And I tend to look more at the year-on-year than the quarter-to-quarter because of these kind of challenges. But so that's where the big job losses take place in the Western Cape. Agriculture, private business services, there was a fair bit in trade and in government. And the next question is on continental issues. I think the WEF specifically discussed Zimbabwe. I think what the WEF Africa discussion was more how do we create conditions for peace on the continent? Because lack of conflict is a big boost to economic development. So it was more focused on that. And one of the key things is this is complicated relationship. If you don't have development, you have conflict. If you have conflict, you don't have development. So the big story is infrastructure, to try to beef up and strengthen infrastructure in SADC so that you can have railway lines and roads that move goods between countries, so that you've got investors who are confident they'll have a regular supply of electricity and water and so on. So that's been where there's a whole focus area just on infrastructure development on the continent and the sub-region. On mergers and monitoring of commitments, there's a few mechanisms. And I have earlier this year asked that we relook how to strengthen them further. So the first one is companies are obliged to report to the Competition Commission on compliance with these conditions, and the Commission can obviously investigate if there's any doubt about it. Secondly, more recently we've created now boards where we would have government officials involved to receive reports. Third, we we started now with the example of Walmart, a high-level discussion between the company and government at ministry level to see whether the claims that are made at the micro level bears out when we aggregate them, when we look at them as a whole. And the fourth one is I've asked for a light performance audit. It's not really an audit, so I'm cautious about using the words because it doesn't have the rigor of an audit. But I'm asking now that we do site visits, we speak to customers and clients and so on, and one staff member has now begun to look at that, just so that we get a multiple set of information on whether a company is complying. And finally, of course, on the jobs thing itself, the unions themselves will also play a role in monitoring that. So this is an area that I think we're beginning to do a little bit more work to make sure that we achieve the outcomes that I expect. For companies, the risks are very high. They're in breach of their compliance or their commitments to the competition authorities, the consequences are pretty far-reaching. For Honorable Cardo's questions, on the Flanders project, the project is a three-year project, and it's got essentially three focus areas that I can recall. The first focus area is on policy development, what work we should do in government that can help to strengthen the social economy. The second one is provision for us to employ a specialist, an international specialist, technical specialist, that can look at the social economy. And in the UN system, the ILO has a mandate for the social economy. So they've got some people who've done quite a bit of work in India, in Spain, in other countries on the social economy. And the third one is advocacy work with stakeholders. With the social economy, it's not an economy government can create. It's something government can support, but you need the entrepreneurial energy to come from communities. And so a lot of the advocacy work, say cooperatives are one example of the social economy, it's to strengthen people's access to skills. We talked a couple years ago, but I'm not quite sure. I haven't had an update recently to get some of the universities to do the equivalent of an MBA, but on the social economy. And we should see where we've come with that. So those are the three areas: public advocacy among stakeholders, technical expertise, and policy work. On the second question on the price difference system, because it last year, what the ZED focused on was not the challenge that we originally dealt with. It was a second problem, scrap metal. We've dealt with the first one is the original purpose of the PPS. But in addition to that, we've also had enormous theft of cable, copper cable and metal from public infrastructure. So we've done quite a bit of things. Colleagues and honorable members will recall that we did work with the Department of Justice on a Criminal Matters Amendment Act, as it eventually became known, where we beefed up the sentences and the policing regime. Now, this focuses on the export regime to try to discourage the level of theft that we have. So we're working downstream to try to drive up the upstream market for stolen cable and metal. As far as I'm aware, there's been the workshop that ITAC has held. They're still working on it. They haven't given me their report yet on where they are with their thinking. And I'm looking forward to it, too, because there's obviously urgency with us to address the theft issues. We've had some relief with the new act being in place, but we need to work on a couple of fronts to be able to achieve that. I would be very happy to report back as soon as I've been further briefed by ITAC on that. On the public interest guidelines, on the Ricardo pointed out to the very interesting formulation on constitutionally entrenched rights. And I was also quite intrigued when I saw it. And essentially, the competition authorities have to use the Act as their basis. And in the Act, there are four public interest tests, and one of it is the impact on industries and regions. Now, the question is impact on which industries. So because the Act does not explicitly delineate what the authorities should use as the basis, or they've given it, I think, a pretty valiant attempt to give it some content. The overriding criteria with all public authorities is we must always give effect to the Constitution. So that's the basic law. So in everything we do, there can always be a point taken. How does that advance the constitutional values and so on? So I think they're making sure that there's at least that connection to the Constitution. I could imagine media issues that may be relevant, that one would want to ensure that you have a diversity of opinion in media so that the right to freedom of the press can actually be achieved. If you had a single media provider in the entire country, that would obviously mitigate, I guess, the expression of a constitutional freedom. So I would be happy to ask the competition authorities whether there's thought of any others they may well be. For example, there's a constitutionally entrenched right to health. And in the House last week, in response to a question that was put to me, I began to elaborate a little bit how we see the market inquiry to be relevant to issues of access to health. So I think it would be perhaps a few areas like that, but I am really at the stage just putting forward some initial thoughts. It would need a bit more thinking to see what exactly will forward in that that event. Honourable, I'm assuming this question on DISAM, I think it's given the public officials a much better sense of the issues of how do you measure impact and how you can use it for policy making. And we've trained people now from Environment, the Department of Environmental Affairs, DTI, DPME, which monitors and evaluates programs, Department of Public Works, and also the University of Pretoria. So we've brought together people across different areas. The early days to see, I hope we can get a bit of a handle, because we often have quite extravagant claims that are made about the impact of policy. And it's a little bit more rigid. If we say it's granted 3,000 jobs, and there's one method we use to describe the job, but different public entities use their own definitions. So I've seen projects that are proposed, sometimes it comes to us, and the figures you can see use a very strange definition. So that is enough to bring a bit of rigor and tightness to how you evaluate the social impact of projects. On the question that came up on youth unemployment, I want to link that also with the question the Chair has asked on sustainability. And it's an important issue for us to think about. Perhaps what we should do is we should rise to the request by the Chair and do a little report looking over a very long period, perhaps take something if we can find good and bad examples. Because we take also the ones where we've not been able to maintain something to see what are the lessons. And look at the impact of public support for enterprises and whether those enterprises are sustainable. Now we give quite a significant discount. Some of the discount on market is prime minus 3%, so for youth-owned enterprises. Now to give you an idea, if you've got a fairly big company and you go to Standard Bank, and you say, I want to borrow money, Standard Bank will typically give you prime. The IBC gives a small youth-owned enterprise a better rate than Standard Bank will give a big company. Now, why big and small is important is a big company with track record, at least in theory, is less risky. It doesn't always work like that. They often come with risks, but on the whole, you know, a Standard Bank that you're less likely to lose your money. A smaller, newer company may have a higher attrition rate, so you've got a higher chance of losing your money. So they tend to price that into their interest rates. So they charge the smaller players more because it's riskier. But in the market, the smaller players often need the discount even more than the bigger ones. So this is where public funding comes in. We can often manage to come in at a lower price than the commercial banks. We've got to take more risks. It's by its nature that we will take risks that don't go well at times, but we need to be able to show that we did apply ourselves. It's not a free-for-all. So it's quite an interesting thing, and I would like to put together a little thing that we can perhaps respond more concretely to both to Honourable Matsibe and the Chair's points. On Honourable Taylor's question on Coca-Cola and the spada shops, Coca-Cola is going to make available about 400 million rand for retail outlets, and what they indicated to us is that they think their, let's call it their larger plan, may well involve something like 25,000 new retail outlets, spas and shops, and so on. They may make the decision. It's their distribution network. So on top of years, if it's a new township that's been built, or a new section in the township, I'm sure people will put up their hand and will put in applications to go. Our intention with this thing is to make sure that the overall development is positive. We're less interested in name of the person who gets it, because we want to see that Black South Africans get it, that small players get it, that new entrants get it, rather than that a particular identified person gets it. So that would be the process. On the other question that the chairperson asked, which is, do we feel we have the quality among young entrepreneurs? And I would make two points. I would say, on one hand, young people have less experience than older people. But in many parts of the world, and in South Africa, that's sometimes been turned to an advantage. That they're prepared to take a bit more risk, to do things. I mean, if you think of the digital economy, the old generation could not have conceived of it. They would not have been prepared to take the risks that young people take. So you need young people's risk-taking, passion, and savviness, connectedness, as much. The economy needs young people. It's not just that we're doing it to help young people, we're doing it to help the economy. So I think what one must do, though, is find a balance where the empowerment notion becomes a driver and not a constraint. If young people believe that the way forward in life is simply to ask for more, they don't get to develop the skills that they need. If you place some of the risk on them, if you put self-responsibility and hard work in, among young people and entrepreneurial opportunities, I've seen incredibly successful and good examples of young people rise to the occasion. But it's to manage that carefully, that we have a culture where people know that success or failure ultimately depends on what they bring to a business. Yes, the state must support. Yes, society must support. Yes, we need empowerment codes and so on. But if that becomes a substitute, you can't get a guaranteed way to make money. If there's a guaranteed way to make money, it's corruption. It's not entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship means there's a chance to lose and there's a chance to gain. And it's bringing that in. And this is why corruption is so corrosive of what we try to do. The minute a minister or a DG or DDG or head of a development finance institution leans on the people who must make the decision to give money to a particular individual, two things happen. The DFIs don't look at the business plan carefully anymore because they feel this pressure on them. So they may approve a plan that is defective, where the plan could have been improved, it could have been made right, but now you pass it through. But the second thing that we do is we teach the young entrepreneur that it's through connections that they go forward in life. And so when they hit problems where connections can't help, they stump, they don't know what to do. So the fight against corruption in all of its forms is really an important part of getting economic development in the country. And so when we say that a strong national treasury with integrity is important, we don't only mean it morally. Of course, we mean that too. But it's fundamental to economic development. If you don't have that, you will damage your economy severely. No economy has grown through corruption anywhere in the world. Flat, straight, simple economics. It grows through entrepreneurship, it grows through energy, innovation, investment, the saving of your sources, and then you invest your savings in expansion. That's the way in which economies thrive. So just to make that underline that point that's come out. On the question of the fourth industrial revolution, can we navigate it successfully? Jefferson, we have to. This is the world that we may not have chosen. It's the world that's evolving there. Technology throughout human history is a force that human beings can shape, but not completely control and completely resist. So we have to find the opportunity in it. So I think the question that was raised, whether we can get basic education and higher education ministers to also look at what this means for the training systems in the country, absolutely fundamental. I think if you can't create the new kind of young person or entrepreneur, then the opportunity come. We taught for all technology, the world has moved on. And just like it doesn't make sense to teach people today, you know, to put everybody into what's in cast technology, because the world is different. So we've got to begin to embrace that. On the question of youth feeling discouraged by service providers, I think it's an important point. We're working with the IDC now to ensure that even when they don't approve projects, that they come back quickly and that they give reasons. That people must know that you mustn't be hostage to a bureaucracy, put in an application and all that comes back many months later is no. So it's an area that perhaps in one of the presentations I should look a little bit whether we're making progress with that. And I intend to make that one of the issues I will take up with the IDC board shortly. On the question of Kula and the direct lending, we'll pull all of that into the case study that the chair suggested that I think we need to do. And then on the IDC investment in risk or in risky locations on the rest of the continent, I think, Chair, you've given half the part of the answer, which is we ourselves are regarded as risky. But what the IDC normally do is they assess risk. And just like you could have a set of challenges in the country, doesn't mean every investment opportunity is risky there. And the IDC typically takes out political risk cover. So they do try to identify the risks. But obviously it is our continent in the end. So we've got to be prepared to also sometimes move into riskier than normal environments to help stabilize it. If the continent does well, South Africa does well. It's really, that's really our long-term mantra. This is ultimately where wealth can be created on the continent. On the Competition Act amendments, it's been a very interesting experience because we've come up with quite a few changes that we think were necessary. As we engage with more players and we look at the emerging jurisprudence, also we look at the decisions from the Competition Appeal Court, and we engage on those. We then know that we've got to refine some of our thinking. So I've done a detailed workshop a few weeks ago where I spoke at the workshop that the judge resident and the University of Cape Town, etc. There's another three key competition conferences in the next 4 to 6 weeks, some that the private sector, private law firms are setting up. And when we've gone through all of that and we've seen how the new provisions have been implemented, we definitely want to come back to Parliament. But this is one example where the delays are for the best reasons, that we're enriching our own thinking by taking more views into account and watching the jurisprudence. So we will come back. Perhaps one of the things we can do in one of the sessions is just take one or two of the concepts and discuss it a little bit within the committee, just by way of also giving the committee an early sense of the complexities of the issues. I could try to put that into either the next one or the one thereafter, quarterly report, put a few slides together on that could help to identify the issues. I think I've covered most of the questions that were put, and I'd like to just really appreciate the questions and the opportunity that the committee has given us to elaborate a little bit on the work of the department. Thank you very much.
Just on the ITA amendment.
ITAC itself has said to us that they having a rethink. So they had originally proposed some changes and then asked for more time. So in the case of the competition things, we're trying to work through the issues. In the ITAC one, we are waiting where the commission wants to go with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. I'm not going to allow further questions, but just to indicate that I was surprised when I was quiet the whole time. Quite surprising. But Minister, belated happy Eid. I think we forgot when you opened. We hope you really enjoyed it. The two issues that we've agreed on, the proposal by, I just wanted to amend the proposal by Mr. Atkinson. While I fully agree with what you said, but I would also want to really approach it in a way that says for every international visit, or not just visit, yeah, for every international visit, whether conference, workshop, or visit, just visitation, or exchange yes, experiences should be more appropriate. I think would like the minister to brief us, but then the management committee will then decide as to which topic the minister must bring in the report. I think if it's like that, then it gets guided. So that, because normally these reports can be quite long, and if you're going to combine everything at once, it might be time-consuming, and we might not really, the minister might not benefit from our discussions. So that's the amendment I wanted to bring in. The other one is on the research. I think what we need perhaps might be the time frame. I know it's going to be quite an involved thing. So perhaps we can see whether before the end of the term, when we say in the term, that's 2019, can we give it 2017 will be fine. Somewhere at the end of the fourth term, towards the end of the fourth term, 2017. Okay. If we can stick to that. But otherwise, thank you very much, Minister, the DM, Acting CG, and the rest of the creative management for preparing this presentation, this report. I think the presentation, Minister, is quite as usual, quite good, and many issues were clearly explained, and we were able to follow, and I think the engagement with your African counterparts to tell on the issues around the fourth industrial revolution are quite help. I think they are going to assist us, especially in changing our perspectives, I think, on most of the issues related to how we approach issues, in economic issues in the future, especially in relation to growth and general development issues, and also towards job creation. I think we must begin to look at things in that way so that we can see also assist in the discussion wherever we are. On the matter that the minister is now of the youth, the corruption and you know, people using their contacts, I think you are right. But at the same time, I think members here, all of them are in the constituencies, and you know, whenever a constituency member brings issues to you, you know, they bring them confidence that you will be able to intervene. So I think while I agree that, you know, having certain people that you know in certain offices should not be abused, but at the same time, I think it should be taken seriously that members and so forth are bringing issues. I'm saying that because officials also must begin to take matters that are brought by constituent offices seriously, because in some cases they are not taken seriously. Hence, the loss of faith and by members of our community on members of parliament because they think they are not doing our work. So I think that should be, I'm not saying in the case of community development, because I know that whenever we bring our issues, they are taken care of. But then I just wanted to clarify that in case people might think that you were referring to normal issues that are brought, you know, to yourself, you know, in a proper manner. So thanks for that. And may we then agree that we close the meeting on that note after 10 minutes.